most people are going to be able to make, you know, really high quality shorts. And it's not going to be based on the budget you have or the studio you're affiliated with. It's going to be based on your creativity and your sense of story and doing something new. And I think that's a pretty exciting world. If I just read a Wikipedia article, I would not have remembered it. I might have not even understood it. But this is a conversation that I had with Conmigo 3-4 months ago, and I now know it deeply, and I'm not forgetting it. And it shows you the power of Socratic dialogue. It forces you to bring as much to the table as a teacher does. You're going to be able to chat with Conmigo the same way that we're chatting right now. It's going to be able to make eye contact with you. It's going to be able to read your expressions, tell that you're frustrated. And I know we're going to have to put some guardrails on there so it doesn't get too creepy, but it could be very powerful if you use it well.
I was reading your book. I realized that it's actually a book about more than just AI and education. It's about your vision of how AI will fit into our world. Conmigo is a very personalized experience. It's just like Conmigo and the student. But like much about what we are as humans is collaboration, right? Like in the classroom, we have other people, which, well, maybe not often enough, but we still collaborate. So how are you thinking about this shift to personalized tutoring? What will we do to our abilities of collaborate? How people will learn to collaborate as a group?
Hey, I'm Alexander, and welcome to Before AGI. To me, if I think about the positive impacts of AI, education is the one that feels the most exciting and profound. Not only personally, as an educator and a parent, but more broadly, as I truly believe that accessible and high-quality education is the great equalizer. But the positive story of AI and education is definitely not a straightforward affair. When ChatGPT came out, the education community reacted rather negatively. But Salkan, who is our guest today, was someone who saw an opportunity there. In March of last year, Khan Academy launched Khanamigo, a sort of artificial teaching assistant powered by GPT-4, the model behind ChatGPT. An AI teaching assistant that aims to provide to all children across the world the same type of personal tutoring that Alexander the Great got from Aristotle. And he also wrote a book called Brave New Worlds, How AI Will Revolutionize Education and Why That's a Good Thing, that I highly recommend. Today, we talked about the vision put forth in this book, the opportunities for education that AI presents, and the challenge emerging along the way.
Sal, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Alexander.
So, it's November 2022. ChatGPT comes out. A lot of people view it almost as a technology that will majorly undermine or even existential threat to education. Many, but not you. It seems that, you know, the first thought in your mind when you see this is essentially what became Conmigo. So why? Where are we coming from to get to that conclusion?
Yeah, actually, when ChatGPT in particular came out, I was a little bit bummed. And I'll tell you why, but I'll tell you how things have evolved since then. If we rewind about 3-4 months before that, Sam Altman, Greg Brockman from OpenAI reached out to me and our team and said, hey, we're training our next model, which ended up becoming GPT-4. And they said, we think this is going to be a really interesting model, and we want to lead with social positive use cases with organizations that folks trust. And so we want to explore if there's something that Khan Academy might leverage it for. And I was skeptical. I thought GPT-2 and GPT-3 were very cool and, you know, amazingly cool, but I didn't think they were ready for prime time. But when I saw, and, you know, this was, I think we were some of the first people in the world to see what GPT-4 could do. This was in, I want to say, August of 2022. It had some rough spots, but it was able to do things that I don't think anyone thought a generative AI was going to be able to do anytime soon, which is really take on a persona, drive a conversation, seemingly to be able to do reasoning, which I know is a big area for artificial intelligences. And if you think about everything that Khan Academy is about, a lot of folks know I started on this journey tutoring my cousins, and then I started writing software for them, making videos for them. And everything we've done over the last 15 plus years has been trying to scale what a great personal tutor would do. And so when we saw what GPT-4 could do, we said, this changes everything. This could allow us to lean in more. Now, as soon as we started to explore it, you could imagine the debates that we were having inside of Khan Academy. And this was happening September, October of 2022. And we were all under a non-disclosure agreement with OpenAI. And so we couldn't talk about it publicly, couldn't even tell my family about it. But we were saying, well, this is cool, but how do you handle, you know, when it makes up facts, hallucinations, how do you handle math errors? You know, people trust Khan Academy to help them with things like math. How do you handle safety? If we're talking about under 18 users using it, how do you have oversight? How do you handle cheating? It was very obvious to us as soon as this is a cool tool, but if someone wanted answers, it could give answers. So we were, and I encouraged the team to say, hey, let's write all these risks down, but let's turn them into features. Let's make it so that a teacher can see what's going on. Let's have an AI, and we worked with OpenAI on this, you know, using can moderate and then automatically send messages to teachers and parents if something seems off. Let's prompt what would become Khanmigo, our instance of our helper, to not give you the answer and make it very hard for it to give you the answer, but it will be Socratic and it will nudge you forward the way that a good ethical tutor would. So we were building all of these features in secret in October, November, and then November 29th, ChatGPT comes out, which, as we know, sometimes ChatGPT is used synonymously with the models themselves, but ChatGPT is really an application that's built on top of, initially it was built on top of GPT 3.5, and now obviously it can work on 4 and other models. But I immediately slacked Greg Brockman at OpenAI, and I'm like, hey Greg, what's going on here? You have us under a non-disclosure agreement. We can't talk about anything. You just launched something. I didn't think we were going to launch GPT-4 until March of 2023. And Greg immediately says, no, you know, we didn't think we were launching anything. We just put a chat interface on top of a model that was already out, GPT 3.5. And the whole world kind of blew up. And immediately, as you mentioned, a lot of educators became very concerned because it was very clear that you could ask ChatGPT to write things for you and do some of your homework for you. And we immediately saw a lot of school systems by December, even January of that year, start to ban it. And I was, you know, I couldn't talk about what we were doing then, but I was on TV telling people like, hey, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. These are skills that people are going to have to develop for the workforce. How do you use these tools? And there might be ways to use them that they can enhance learning and actually not only not cheat, but undermine cheating. So the good news is by the time March 15th came around, which is when both GPT-4 launched and Khanmigo launched, which was leveraging GPT-4, the school system had come around full circle. They had said, look, maybe ChatGPT isn't right for younger students. It could be in certain cases if they're learning to use the industry tools. But if only someone could take the same technology and put the right guardrails, make it special purpose for an education setting, not allow cheating, that could be really exciting. And so then when we were able to show Khanmigo, it was a very positive reception.
Okay, so there is lots to unpack here. So let's go by this. So I guess you were bummed because it was a little bit earlier than you expected and kind of spoiled the surprise or spoiled the all the excitement that was building up. But like, yeah, how was this in to live in the world where you know something about the future that no one else around you knows it? So like, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, well, I was bummed. One, it spoiled the surprise a little bit, or a lot, really. But I was also bummed because it put it out there. You know, the first foot that generative AI put out into the mainstream, especially the education world, was, hey, this could be used for cheating. And by the way, it still can hallucinate, and it's not particularly good at math. And so I was even more afraid that the baby was going to get thrown out with the bathwater, that the education world would just say, we want nothing to do with large language models, which would have been a shame because I think there's a lot of opportunity for it to help learners, help teachers. And we were working on this. I've been pivoting the entire organization. When Sam and Greg first showed me GPT-4, I'm like, okay, this is the future of Khan Academy. We're going to rebuild Khan Academy around this, which is really what we have been doing ever since then. And so that was my biggest fear in terms of knowing something that the rest of the world didn't know. Yes, I have trouble keeping secrets. I'll be very open. This was the hardest secret that I ever kept because it was so obvious that this was going to change civilization. And there's very few times that you can say that with a straight face, but I said it back in August, September of 2022, and I believe it more than ever. And not only, you know, now I obviously can talk openly about it. I tell folks, if all we had was GPT-4, the first version of GPT-4 for the next 10 years, we will see incredible innovation. What's amazing is already GPT-4 Turbo is better than GPT-4, and you know, any clues I can get from y'all about what GPT-5 can do, I'm all ears. I'm always trying to, you know, get some clues. And obviously y'all aren't the only ones working on it. There's other very well-resourced organizations that are also entering this arms race, if you will. So the technology is getting so good so fast. Everything I'm telling the team at Khan Academy is, what are our pedagogical goals? And let's build things that are going to be able to surf the wave of this underlying technology getting better and better and better.
Yeah, so many great points. First of all, I do agree that like even if we stop the research, I think AI will change the world anyway. And that's something important to realize. Maybe people don't see it right away, the change, but the change is happening. It's also interesting. So you said, okay, GPT-4 is great. GPT-4 Turbo is even better. And yeah, if you sign an NDA, we could tell you a little bit more about what's coming. But then you wouldn't be able to tell anyone. So I'm not sure if you want to go there.
I'm ready to sign those NDAs, by the way. So yeah, we'll talk.
Yes, but just the question is, so okay, but they are not perfect. By the way, I also like the fact that you're saying, okay, you want to build in a way in which whenever the better model, base model comes in, you can swap it in. So I think that's a very important principle. But yes, you said GPT-4 was great, but not perfect. So what was kind of the things that you already mentioned, some of them that you had to work with? Like, can you tell us some story about like, what was the particular thing that you needed to debug or improve to make it useful for Khan Amigo?
Yeah, that very first weekend that OpenAI gave, they gave access to myself, our chief learning officer, and our chief technology officer. And that weekend, we didn't sleep. We were, you know, 2 a.m, we were all on, and we were like, look, we were taking screenshots. I was like, look, I got it to do this. Look, I got it to do that. And they're like, this changes everything. But then one of us say, yeah, but it got 17 plus 16 wrong. So how do we handle that? Or I remember we were looking for a CFO at the time, and I didn't realize that it was not connected to the internet. So I asked it, hey, can you go on LinkedIn and can you find some great candidates for Khan Academy to be our next CFO? And it created it, or at the time I thought it found 3 really amazing resumes. I'm like, this is incredible. And look at the person even lives in Mountain View. They could walk to our office and they have a perfect background. And I quickly realized that it completely fabricated these profiles, that they were perfect, but these people just didn't exist. So we discovered the hallucination issue, or if you asked it particular, you know, what's the mass of the sun? Sometimes it would give you the right number. Sometimes it would be off a little bit. So these were real issues. Now, some of it, as we pointed it out to the OpenAI team, you know, and we'll take credit for it, we helped discover a little bit of errors in the training data itself, because obviously y'all have some human laborers, labelers, I should say, who are, you know, feeding what the right response should be. And sometimes they make mistakes. And some of that was underlying some of the math errors. But we were just saying, look, this is the future. We need to just figure out ways to mitigate it. We realize if we anchor it on Khan Academy content, it's way less likely to hallucinate. It almost eliminated it. If, you know, we worked with your research team to think of ways that you can have multiple calls to the AI to check itself to really improve the math, we got better and better at prompting it. You know, it's interesting. My kid's school, one of the parents was one of the lead researchers on Gemini at Google. And he said, you know, the one thing that we didn't realize, but to some degree, obviously ChatGPT helped people realize and Khanmigo helped them realize, is the power of prompting that you can get, that, you know, some of these models out the box, when you make it, you just say, hey, do this, it does it okay. But if you give it a really thoughtful prompt and you really experiment with the prompt, you can make it do a lot more than you might have thought initially. So that was our primary way of mitigating it, just building a lot of infrastructure and a lot of context for the AIs. And obviously over the last year, the underlying models have gotten dramatically better. I know this is something front of mind for those creating the models, like how do we reduce hallucinations? How do we get the math to be much better? It's still not perfect. And then this is an area of focus for us too.
Sounds great. So this is actually like there are 2 tidbits that I discovered doing the research for the show that surprised me. First of all, you finished MIT, so go Beavers. That's something I definitely can relate to. But other, you actually wanted to work on AI even when you were at MIT. So in some sense, it all came full circle that, you know, with Khanmigo, you kind of are coming back to AI. But like, why didn't you stick with AI to begin with?
Yeah, I think you read my book, Brave New Words. The last chapter, I confessed that I wanted to be an AI researcher when I was at MIT. And it's true. When I was a freshman at MIT, You know, I originally thought I wanted to be a physics major, and then I got really into computing, and I just thought, well, the most philosophically interesting thing is, could we create machines that could really emulate human intelligence in a very substantive way? And so my freshman advisor, I sought out Henry Patrick Winston, who wrote the seminal textbook on artificial intelligence and taught the intro course at MIT. I took Society of Mind, which was by Marvin Minsky, who was Professor Winston's mentor. Yeah. He was a consultant for 2001, The Space Odyssey, when Stanley Kubrick made that movie. So these were the titans in artificial intelligence in the mid-90s that I had access to. And I took all of these courses, and but I started to get kind of disillusioned pretty fast, where, yes, we knew how to make things that could play checkers and chess quite well. You know, expert systems were all the rage back then. But at the end of the day, they weren't doing it the way that humans do it. They were algorithmic. You were doing these searches through kind of decision trees when you're playing chess or checkers. Like, okay, if they move this, then what are the possible moves? Okay, out of those moves, then what would you do? And then we'll score the last moves and then go back to pick what move you're going to do. Or these expert systems that's just trying to, you know, they can sometimes emulate thought, but they were just trying to find the next if-then statement that kind of applied to that situation. And that's very different to how humans learn. Humans literally can learn based on new experience. They can self-correct. And obviously, even then, we knew that the brain was a bunch of neurons with synapses. And obviously, people have been working on, you know, there's always been this argument in the AI community. Do you try to do things more programmatically or more algorithmically, or do you do things where you just try to emulate nature? But at the time in the mid-90s, you know, neural nets existed, but they were pretty bad. You know, we didn't have the computation. And obviously, there's been breakthroughs in even how you structure and train neural nets since then. But I got disillusioned. I said, you know, artificial intelligence, at least in mid-90s, isn't really going to go anywhere. Let me do something else with my life. I obviously stayed in tech to some degree. I actually got very interested in education then. I kind of said, well, if I can't use tech to emulate intelligence, maybe I could use tech to enhance intelligence. So even back in college, I worked on some projects to create some math software to help people learn, et cetera. But I had given up at the time. And I wrote in the book, you know, I didn't realize, but that was a little bit of a lull in AI research back then. And, you know, if what was going on now was going on then, yeah, I would have been all in.
Yeah, no, I knew Patrick and he was a wonderful human being. But yeah, AI, this was not the right time to bet on AI then. It's definitely different now. So, okay, so you embarked on this project of Canamigo, but then you also wrote a book. So it seems like you see Canamigo as a part of a broader picture here, some like AI-driven revolution education. Is that indeed the case? So why did you write this book?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because there was a time that I was skeptical of all books. You know, I love books, but I remember in 2011, I had given a TED Talk early in the days of Khan Academy about what the future of classroom should look like. And a publisher reached out and said, hey, we think you should write a book. And I said, why would I write a book? Anything I need to share, I'll just make a YouTube video and I'll share it with everyone. But they said, no, it can help you structure your thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And I wrote that book. That first book I wrote was called The One World Schoolhouse. And, you know, a third of it was kind of how did education become what it is today? The middle third was how did I fall into education and what Khan Academy is and what's becoming. And the last third is, well, what should the future of education look like given how the world is evolving and how technology is evolving? And that exercise was very powerful for me. It really helped me structure my thoughts. And I've been using it ever since for the last 11, 12 years to help align our team, to help bring funders into our vision as a not-for-profit, to go into schools, or even to just make sure we understand what our true north is as we are building products for classrooms, for students, for teachers. And so when I saw what was happening, you know, this was even before ChatGPT when we were under NDA with OpenAI, I was like, this is the biggest transformation of our lifetime, not just in education, maybe in the world's, you know, in civilization history. And even before the public debate started, I knew that this was going to, a lot of people are going to be afraid of this. There's going to be a lot of armchair philosophers who start saying, oh, well, we should shut this down or this, or I'm afraid of that. And I just wanted to get my own head around it. You know, where are we? What are the implications? And what should we be doing in education and beyond. There's clear, you know, it was obviously it was going to affect the workplace. Some jobs were going to get disrupted. Other jobs were going to get enhanced. It's going to be part of everyone's jobs. So yeah, I was eager to write a book about it. And now that I've gone through the process of writing Brave New Words, it really has done the same thing that my first book did. It's allowed me to frame what the risks are and the opportunities, not just in education, but also in work and credentialing and assessment and all of these areas, and really have a well thought out point of view when people say, oh, we got to shut this down or we should be careful. I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but we should know what we're doing. We should know that if you just run away with fear, the bad actors are going to run faster than you, or they're going to run in the other direction and then you're going to have a lot of bad outcomes. The real goal is how do you mitigate the bad actors, and then how do you squeeze the most juice out of the positive use cases, which is, you know, really what the book tries to advocate for. But it goes very you know, someone said instead of naming the book Brave New Words, How AI Will Revolutionize Education, someone joked that you should name it Brave New Words, all of the fear, each chapter is a fear that people have and how we can address it is kind of how the book is written.
Well, it kind of makes sense then that this book is, like, I love the title, by the way, but just it is a riff on a dystopian vision. So kind of maybe makes sense that this is what you are trying to avoid. But I actually want to zoom in on something you said there, that like you use books as a way to help you structure your thinking. So this is, as you know, one of the big fears about ChatGPT and AI, that essentially like, well, we use writing to structure our thinking to teach us how to think. So now with AI, we will lose that. So what's your perspective on this problem?
I think that's definitely a risk, but I don't think generative AI by itself has introduced that risk. I think we've been facing that risk for decades now, where, you know, a lot of students, Google search, it can be useful, but maybe people are over-reliant on it and they don't have the critical thinking to evaluate their sources or to connect the dots. You know, in the book, I write about the state of cheating. Obviously, ChatGPT introduced this new fear, but, you know, I started, what was the state of cheating before ChatGPT? It was pretty bad. it seems like something has culturally shifted in especially higher education, where it seems eerily okay to cheat for a lot of students, where even when I was in college, you know, maybe you could get a little help with homework or something like that. But most of the people I knew would have really looked at you in a weird way if you wanted to cheat on an exam, even a take-home exam. Based on survey data and other things that I talk about in the book, it seems like that's become much more acceptable. The internet obviously has become much more ubiquitous since we were in college. And so that's made it easier. There's services online well before ChatGPT that are happy to write your essay for you for $5 a page, you know, A- guaranteed. So this was always there. I think the reality is if we're in the workplace, a ChatGPT type tool can be really useful for getting a first draft or tweaking it, but it's still not going to get you to great. And the people who are able to still use that tool well are, for the most part, really good writers. So to really get the most out of it, you need to know the craft that you're trying to get it to do. Same thing with coding. You know, the people who are really getting the most out of AI for coding aren't people who don't know how to code. It's people who know how to code really, really, really well. And then they're getting more productivity enhancements. So I write about this in the book. I think there's three categories in education. There are certain use cases where the main work isn't the writing. Let's say you're writing a journalism story. The main work is going and interviewing people and looking at the public records and observing City Hall or whatever it might be, or the crime scene. And then you need to write about it. And then if ChatGPT can help you get a first draft or help you write faster, and then you still tweak it, make it a great article, that's great. If you're going to write a business plan, the business plan isn't what the business is about. It's a tool for running the business or for getting investment. If it can help you get there faster, great. Help you do projection spreadsheets, that's great. And it's actually going to be a very important tool for people to know how to do that in the workplace. The other extreme is you want students to just, you know their grammar, be able to write cogently, be able to structure, write a thesis, a topic sentence and supporting sentences. So in the book, I do advocate that teachers do a little bit more in class for that kind of stuff so that students aren't using ChatGPT or whatever. And then there's a whole middle ground where we do want students to do independent work, but we really want to know that they're not using an AI to do the work for them. But maybe the AI can support them and even in some ways undermine cheating by giving the teacher more visibility on the whole process. So that's what we're trying to do with Conmigo. We have a version we've already launched. Another version is coming out in Back to School where the AI actually helps the student think about the prompt, come up with a thesis statement. We have a whole, you know, it's not just a chat interface. We have a whole outlining tool where you can outline and the AI knows about that and you can talk about it and then you can get feedback. And then the AI is going to report to the teacher, not just the final output, but also, hey, we worked on this for 4 hours. Sal had a little bit of trouble with this, but he got past it. I'm confident it is his work because it is his work because it's consistent with his other work. And if I went to ChatGPT or if I got my sister to write it or if I got some internet service to write this paper, and I just copy and pasted it in, Conmigo will tell the teacher, I don't know where this paper came from. It's shady and it's not consistent with his other writing. So not only does that undermine AI cheating, it undermines most forms of cheating. It supports the student better and it supports the teacher better, getting them more insights. So once again, I'm optimistic that if we think about this the right way, we can mitigate those fears and actually do some really powerful, positive things.
So happy to hear that there is hope at the end of the tunnel. Again, being a higher education teacher, teaching does happen. It's regrettable, and I teach usually more mathy subject when it's a bit harder, but it still happens nonetheless. So that's the reality. And yeah, I think part of this is culture. So actually, like, changing the topic a little bit, but the one thing that stood out to me from your book is that kind of you had this vision that, oh, the student will learn how to design the experiment from Marie Curie directly, or, like, you know, co-write the Federalist paper with Hamilton. So why? Like, again, it's fun, it's cool, but, like, pedagogically, like, from educational point of view, like, why this is the right way to go about this?
Well, it allows it to come alive in ways that, you know, would have been science fiction even a few years ago. I think many of us have seen Star Trek: The Next Generation. And when we saw the holodeck, I thought that was the most unrealistic part of the whole show, even for the 24th century. I thought that was unrealistic. And the fact that already on Conmigo, you can have a conversation with an AI simulation of Harriet Tubman or Marie Curie or Eeyore the Donkey is pretty cool. And we're already getting a lot of feedback from teachers and students that it really immerses them in that experience. And then, you know, as I mentioned in the book, where this is going, and especially if you start thinking about, you know, you put your Apple Vision Pro on, you have augmented or virtual reality, you will be able to do the holodeck of Star Trek, where the characters are going to have GPT 5 or 6 under, and they're going to fully pass the Turing test. You're not going to be able to tell whether it's a real person there or not. But they're always going to be there for you, and you're going to be able to enter their worlds, or they're going to be able to enter your worlds. And when you do that, the learning just becomes, you know, we could read about Julius Caesar and the Ides of March and all of that, or we could go to Rome and be a senator and experience it, witness it for ourselves, maybe intervene in those experiences. That changes everything. Or if I'm learning calculus, but I'm learning it by debating with Newton or Leibniz, that changes everything. You know, a lot of reasons why people want to go to great universities, they say, I want to talk to the Nobel Prize winner. I want to be around people that have done interesting things. Well, this might make that type of thing way, way more accessible.
Well, so maybe you will create a simulation of yourself so people can get education from Sal Khan directly. I'm sure it crossed your mind, and I think that would be actually pretty entertaining. So, cool. In your book, actually, you also mentioned multiple times this principle of educational bravery. And can you walk me through this concept? Like, what do you mean by educational bravery here?
Yeah, and you know, educated bravery is how I've been referring it through most of the book. And it really is what I described when we saw the potential of generative AI back in 2022, but we were also very aware of the risks of it. There's two approaches. You could write all these risks down and say, okay, that's too scary for us. Let's just not do anything. Or you could say, let's write the risks down. Let's not ignore them. That's also irresponsible. But let's turn them into features. Let's mitigate them. And let's think about how we can power through and get far more benefit that make these risks well worth it, especially once you mitigate those risks. So that's what I would call educated bravery. You are educating yourself about the risks, the downfalls. You're not blindly optimistic, but you are proactive and trying to do something about it. And you're being brave about it. You're not afraid. You know, one of the biggest risks of organizations that have been successful is they have a reputation. You know, a lot of people trust Khan Academy. And there were conversations like, well, you know, what if there's a math error on KhanMigo and people trust Khan Academy? And this is where it took a little bit of bravery. We said, look, the right thing to do is to invest here, to make it work better and make it, you know, there's all sorts of ways we can make it better. So that's mitigating the risks. We should also be super open and transparent with people about where its weak spots are. So we don't want to misrepresent anything. Make it clear that this is an experiment or this is a something that is rapidly improving. We should educate people on how they handle when there's a mistake. And by the way, the threshold should not be perfection. The threshold should be relative to what people are already experiencing, relative to the status quo. I would say in a lot of cases when I, you know, if I remember my school days, even my college days, every 4 or 5 lectures, someone would raise their hand and say, oh, professor, I think you got that wrong. You know, I think there's a negative there. You missed it. So nothing is perfect. And so how do you make sure that people have the context and the realization there, but keep moving forward? So the educated part, you know, the risks, you're mitigating them, you're educating others about them. But then the bravery one is you're not afraid. You continue to move forward.
Yeah. So I love that. And actually, it really is very reminiscent of what we do at OpenAI. So we have this iterative deployment principle where we kind of carefully deploy new models to exactly understand better both the opportunities but also the risks, and kind of then, of course, acting on them and being pretty open about this. So in particular, in my role at OpenAI, I'm heading something called preparedness effort, which exactly tries to understand these risks of like what the cutting edge AI brings. But again, you want to be like open about this, transparent, and you want to be careful, but you want to push ahead. It's not about not doing anything, it's just understanding all the facets of the problem. So this absolutely resonates with me. So great. So another thing I wanted to ask you about is, okay, KhanMigo is a very personalized experience. It's just like KhanMigo and the student. But like much about what we are as humans is collaboration. Right? Like in the classroom, we have other people, which, well, maybe not often enough, but we still collaborate. So how are you thinking about this shift to personalized tutoring? What will we do to our abilities of collaborate? How people will learn to collaborate as a group?
Yeah. And one, and this is something we've always said at Khan Academy, is if certain things like your individual practice, you can do that more efficiently or more productively, then it could free up more class time to do a simulation, do a game, do a Socratic dialogue. So those could be low-tech ways where the technology is able to offload some of the things. And so when humans get together, they can interact more, which isn't happening enough in most classrooms. Most classrooms are not about Socratic dialogue or group projects, or they're about lectures right now. So one is just to liberate the classroom can help. But what is exciting about generative AI is that I do think we're going to have activities using KhanMigo where KhanMigo is facilitating interactions amongst other people, where it's driving the conversation, but the conversation is fundamentally between human beings. We already have KhanMigo facilitating some forms of communication and reporting between teachers and students, allowing teachers, it acts as a teaching assistant to personalize lessons, etc., so that they can make their lessons more engaging and human interactive. But as I wrote in the book, I am excited over the next couple of years of creating activities for classrooms where, it's facilitating the debate between multiple students, or different students have different roles in a simulation, and the AI acts as the dungeon master, so to speak, and bringing them through that simulation. So I think it, you know, one of the things I'm hoping for is, right now, obviously these devices like Alexa or Siri are, you know, they're nowhere near as smart as say a GPT-4. But they will be pretty smart probably in the next couple of years. I'm hoping that when I'm having dinner with my family, you know, and as a parent, sometimes I ask my kids, how's school? They're like, fine. Oh, what do you like this class? Yeah, I like it. Like, you're not having a real conversation. I want to say, hey, Alexa, hey, Siri, can you facilitate a conversation with my family? And so then it can say, okay, Sal, why don't you tell everyone what your biggest fear this week was and how it turned, you know, and then it facilitates. So once again, it's not about somehow taking time away from the family, but it's facilitating us so that we can have a deeper interaction with each other. I'm really excited about those types of possibilities.
Yeah, that's definitely, yes, exactly. What is the good dinner conversation topic? That might be something that you might need AI to help us with. So you mentioned one thing, the Socratic style of like dialogue, essentially. Like, it seems that you are a big fan of Socratic style of teaching. Why? Why this is your favorite way of teaching?
Well, intuitively, I think, and I think experientially, it seems, you know, people have known, obviously Socrates knew about it, but this transcends even Socrates. I'm writing a book list for a newspaper, and one of the books I suggested are the Upanishads, which are a layer of the Vedas, you know, so it's at least 3,000 years old, probably a lot older in an oral tradition. But Upanishads in Sanskrit literally means to sit near. And the Upanishads are essentially students and their teachers having Socratic, even though this was before Socrates existed, conversations about the nature of reality, the purpose of life. And so I think people have always known that this is really a best practice. And anytime we've experienced it, you remember those experiences. I'll give you an example that I've had recently with Conmigo. This was a few months ago. I've taught cosmology on Khan Academy, so I know a lot of the basics of cosmology, but I have always wondered, why does a supernova explode? You know, my intuition would say, hey, if the fusion reaction of a star stops, why wouldn't the star just collapse? And I've done some web searches and I didn't get really satisfying answers for why it's exploding. People would just say, oh, a star of a certain size, fusion stops, it explodes. I'm like, it doesn't make any sense to me. And so I go to Conmigo and I say, why does a supernova explode? And so Conmigo didn't just give me some kind of a Wikipedia entry and say, well, blah, 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 blah. It said, well, what do you know about supernovas? Why do they, what do you know about stars? How are they fueled? And I said, oh, I know, you know, there's a fusion reaction and I'm sure that, you know, that produces all the energy and that produces a lot of outward force to overcome gravity. And so I would guess, and a supernova happens when a star of a certain mass, the fusion runs out of fuel. So why wouldn't it just collapse? And so Conmigo comes back to me with another question, says, well, you know, I think you have a pretty good handle on the basics of what makes a star and when and what causes at least the conditions for a supernova. But let me ask you a question. When a star collapses of a certain size, do you think it collapses slowly or quickly? And I said, well, you know, it only happens when you reach a certain mass of a star. So when we're talking about a supernova, I guess it's happening quickly because the gravity is so strong. And I said, but I still don't get, so it'll collapse quickly. Why would it explode? And then Conmigo said, well, before I, you know, we go there, have you ever seen anything collapse or fall quickly without bouncing? And I said, oh, I literally said, oh, I typed it in. And I said, so you're telling me that it collapses so fast and it compresses the atomic and subatomic particles so much that essentially some of these other forces that, you know, the strong nuclear, or actually not the strong nuclear, but the electromagnetic force, there's it kind of is a spring and it whipsaws back and then it kind of ejects out the outer atmosphere. And then Conmigo said, that's exactly right. You know, have you ever put a ping pong ball on top of a basketball and tried to bounce it? The ping pong ball gets ejected into the air. And I, you know, having, if I just read a Wikipedia article, I would not have remembered it. I might have not even understood it. But this is a conversation that I had with Conmigo 3-4 months ago. And I now know it deeply. And I'm not forgetting it. And it shows you the power of Socratic dialogue. It forces you to bring as much to the table as a teacher does.
Yeah, this is an amazing anecdote. And again, it's unbelievable that you have this conversation with an AI. And also, I love the fact that you said, oh, you know, like there are people, and sometimes I even catch myself saying, okay, I say thank you after interaction with ChatGPT. So, which again, I'm sure the model appreciates, but it's not maybe needed. So yeah, it's kind of, this is the other thing, by the way. And how do you think about this? It's like, how will our anthropomorphization of AI progress as they get better and better, and again, more seemingly human. They're not human, but they're seemingly human.
Well, I don't think it hurts if we continue to treat it as we would want to be treated ourselves. In fact, it's good practice to always be polite. You know, I have friends who work in places like Amazon and Apple, and you know, they work on the in-home devices, and they tell you there's a lot of people who are really abusive to their agents, you know, and that's not good. And, you know, they are obviously working on ways that these devices can say, hey, don't treat me like that. Because honestly, if they're treating the device like that, they might be treating other things and other people like that as well. So I think it's a good thing if these things feel so personable and we appreciate them, that we treat them with good etiquette and good respect. And maybe even ways that it can enhance, you know, maybe they can give us feedback on, hey, you know, a thank you would be nice. Or, you know, most people would like, you know, one day when we can talk, you know, and they can see in our eyes, hey, eye contact is good. Like, you know, I tell this to, we have a school, I'm the chair. It's a separate organization than Khan Academy, Khan Lab School. And, you know, I talk about, you know, I want to help kids do things like have better eye contact, have a better handshake, learn to smile more. It just helps other people in the room with them. It'll help them get jobs. It'll help them make more friends. So, you know, I can imagine a world where the AI can even help coach folks on things like this. So I think that's an overall good thing. You know, it starts to get troublesome if it starts to substitute real human interactions. But once again, it's not that it's definitely going to do that. It's depending on how it's going to be used. Now, there are certain people, loneliness is an epidemic in this country. And this loneliness epidemic has existed well before generative AI. If generative AI, you know, we've all seen the movie Her. If anyone here listening hasn't, they should watch it. It's an excellent movie. And once again, I thought that was science fiction from 50 years in the future. That's going to exist in the next year or two, like 100%. I think it was helping that the protagonist deal with certain things in their life, which could be a good thing. But we just have to pay close attention, making sure that it's going more in the positive direction and less in the negative. And I will say again, things that are already out there, pre-generative AI, social media, et cetera, they're already taking people to these polarizing rabbit holes that make them insecure, et cetera, et cetera. I actually hope that generative AI, and I write about this in the book, where it can almost be our good angel, where it can, you know, be observing what we're doing and say, okay, Sal, you know, you just spent 10 minutes on TikTok. How do you feel? You know, maybe we want to get back to work, or maybe we want to do a meditation right now. Or maybe, are you feeling stressed? Cause you know, I see you're doing this type of search, or I feel like your behaviors look, do you want to talk to me about it? And if we can do that type of thing, that could be really powerful.
Yes. But again, there are also risks here, as you already point out, that like sometimes this, you can also view it as a dystopia when you have this Orwellian control, where kind of you are supposed to behave in certain ways. So again, you are very well aware of that and saying already that you should steer clear of this.
Absolutely. But no, we have to be careful for sure.
Yes. So going back to your children, so similarly to you, I also have kids. So how does, well, both building Khan Academy, but also Khan Amigo, actually influenced your approach to teaching of like how your children learn? Like, do they use Khan Amigo, or like how do they learn?
Yeah, and I have three kids, and you know, in some ways they're a good focus group, where you know they represent a pretty good representation of the types of personalities that you might see and age groups. They all, Khan Lab School uses Khan Amigo on top of Khan Academy. All my kids use it. They've all used it in different ways. And I write in the book, you know, the book starts with an interaction with my daughter, who at the time was, I believe, 11. And this was when I was under NDA. I couldn't even tell her what it was, but I had, you know, what was GPT-4 open. And I prompted it to essentially write a story with us, not for us. And so my daughter would write a little bit, then it would write a little bit. And at some point my daughter wanted to talk to the character that she helped create, Samantha. And she started talking to the character. And I'm like, this is science fiction. And you know, that's how the book starts off, with me describing that the situation. But that gave us all sorts of ideas, like, yeah, why can't we create activities where you can talk to literary figures, historic figures, where students can write a story with the AI, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, seeing my kids, different ages, different personality types. And then obviously we have a school, and Khan Academy works with hundreds of thousands of teachers and students, I mean, millions, tens of millions actually, but formerly works with hundreds of thousands. And to see them use Khan Amigo has given us all sorts of insights about where we need to work harder and other opportunities for the AI.
Yeah, I must say this is a very exciting vision to me. I am also educator, but in the higher education, so I definitely don't get the burnt of this, as you know, the K-12 teachers, they are the real heroes here. And yeah, all of this, well, you know it better than me, but all of this rings very true, that these are the things of the part of the job that they probably really appreciate, being able to offload to AI. So yeah, so this is a very, very positive story. And in some sense, if I view like the Khan Academy as a project. It's kind of this project that translates, you know, progress in technology into progress in education. So we can do video and you have YouTube. So that's what the original Khan Academy was about. Now we have AI. So we have Khan Amigo. So what's next? What is the thing that you are kind of seeing in the future that you might want to add to this collection of technologies to leverage to revolutionize education?
Yeah. And I, you know, I never thought about it, but you're absolutely right. And even before, you know, YouTube got big around 2004, 2005, obviously Khan Academy didn't really exist before then, but you know, even in college in the late 90s, when the internet and web software and things like JavaScript started to become a thing, said, hey, we could write web tools to, and I had worked on one back in the day. And so, and then as soon as YouTube comes out, we were saying, hey, this could be used for education. And then obviously we've been doing a lot over the years. AI, as you know, probably as well as anyone, it's not like we're, you know, it's moving so fast. Just with GPT-4, if nothing else happens, you know, there's so much we could do. A lot of the activities around multi-users and et cetera, that we've talked about, we would be able to do, and we are going to be able to do those things. But then we can talk about multimodal. Like already Khanmigo has text-to-speech and speech-to-text, so it can talk to you and you can talk to it. I predict probably with technology from y'all and others, it's going to get better and better and more natural at all of those things. The underlying models already have multimodal capabilities. They already are capable of not only generating images, but making sense of images. So we've been having conversations inside of Khan Academy about, you know, on the most superficial level, it can, if there's a Khan Academy question that has a diagram or, you know, it's a triangle and you have to figure out if it's similar to another triangle, it's going to get better at those things. But what if we could start figuring out ways to input student work? Actually, the hardest part of this now is how do you capture student work? Most students are not doing work on a tablet. They're doing it on a Chromebook or a laptop of some kind. Can you scan in their paperwork or something like that so that we can give even more insights to the teacher on where students are and also better feedback and better tutoring to the student? The technology already exists for this. We just have to figure out ways to put it together so that it can work well. You imagine 2-3 years in the future, you're going to be able to chat with Khanmigo the same way that we're chatting right now. It's going to be able to make eye contact with you. It's going to be able to read your expressions, tell that you're frustrated. And I know we're going to have to put some guardrails on there so it doesn't get too creepy, but it could be very powerful if you use it well. If you fast forward a few more years, you know, I don't think virtual reality is going to be super mainstream in the next, say, 3 years. But if you go into the 5 to 10 year timeframe, when you have Apple Vision Pro version 4, and it feels just like a piece of glasses you wear, and maybe it's a lot more affordable. Now all of a sudden the AI can be in the same space as you, or you could be in the same space as the AI, or you could together travel the stars or enter into the circulatory system. And you know, once again, this is the holodeck. This is even in the 24th century, I thought that this was not going to happen, but this is probably going to happen in the next decade.
Yeah, so okay, so I guess VR and general Star Trek is coming even before 24th century. So that's pretty much before the schedule. So changing topics a little bit. So one of the more interesting sections in your book is about this economics of education. So could you walk me through this kind of your thinking about the cost of standard education and how you view both Khan Academy and Khan Amigo to change and affect that?
Yeah, you know, I'll start with just some basic stats that are out there. And I talk a lot about these in the book. If I take some of the school districts in the Northeast spend about $35,000 to $40,000 per student per year. New York City in particular spends about $40,000 per student per year. Their average class size is 25 students. So that means $1 million per classroom per year. I guarantee you that is not going to the teacher. And that's also not going to the facilities. If it was going to the facilities, it would look like the Four Seasons. It does not look like the Four Seasons. It would look nicer than the Four Seasons. So where is it going? Well, it's going to a lot of administrative layers, back office. You know, I would say probably 60-70% of those resources are not reaching the students. They're someplace else. So even behind the scenes, you know, I just said, I think the teaching job is not only super safe in an AI world, but it's going to be enhanced in an AI world. But I think some of the other roles, kind of the administrative roles, the registrar's office, the people keeping track of transcripts and scheduling and things like that, I think AI is going to give us a lot of productivity there. So more of that $40,000 can go to pay the teacher more and to improve the experience to the students, lower the student teacher ratio, have better facilities, et cetera. That already is going to enhance education by taking out costs on the back office stuff. You go But a lot, obviously, a lot of what Khan Academy has been about is, if you go through most of human history, the gold standard was always having a personal tutor or small group instruction, or having an apprenticeship where you're working directly with your mentor, with the master craftsman or the master hunter or whatever whoever you're working with. You fast forward to about 200-300 years ago, very utopian idea, mass public education. Before that, most of the world couldn't read. Even in fairly developed parts of the world in 1700, 1600, only about 20 or 30% of the population could read. So mass public education was a very utopian idea. It's done many, many great things, but it made some very real compromises. You know, even when you're spending, like New York City, $40,000 per student per year, they still have to batch these 25 students together, move them at a fixed pace, apply some standards, some processes to them, assess them periodically, start sifting them into different tracks. Okay, you're probably on track to become a researcher, a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer. You're not quite on track to go to college. Maybe you want to go into, you know, one of the trades or something like that. All of that, the Industrial Revolution, because we did not have the resources to do what, you know, Alexander the Great, famously, his tutor was Aristotle. We can't give, or we thought we couldn't give everyone their own Aristotle. But now with the internet has dramatically lowered the marginal cost of disseminating information. Even pre-AI software allows for personalized like experiences to once again be very scalable with, you know, for pennies. That's what Khan Academy is really, you know, there's a lot of ways as a nonprofit to try to have free world-class education for anyone anywhere. Our vector is leverage technology and the power and then the cost curve coming down to be able to reach more and more people in a more and more world-class way. And now with generative AI is, as you know very well, especially if you're using frontier models, it is much more expensive because of the compute costs than, say, serving up a web page. But if you compare it to, say, in-person tutoring, it's a dramatically different cost structure. You know, in most of the US, if you want a decent tutor, you're going to be spending $25 to $50 an hour at least. Now with generative AI, you could probably be looking at on the order of $25 a year to have as much support as you need. And those costs are coming down pretty fast. I think in a year or two, it's going to look more like $5 or $10 per year to get that type of support. And the models and the applications built on those models are going to get better and better and better. So I think it has a huge opportunity for leveling the playing field.
Yeah, so I'm definitely a big believer in this personalized tutoring, but there is also, there must be something more to it, right? So the other piece of information that kind of is quite mind-blowing to me is that during COVID, US government spent billions of dollars on live tutoring for students and didn't really help. On the other hand, I know that Khan Academy actually kind of also, like, just by people like the students who actually use Khan Academy, they seem to have benefited a lot and actually didn't have the COVID, the pandemic dip in their understanding. So clearly there is something more to it than just putting tutors in front of the children. So what do you think it is?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've cited the power of tutoring, and I cite the study from Benjamin Bloom in 1984. This was a TED talk that I gave last year. And I talk about Benjamin Bloom, at least argued that you could get a 2-standard deviation improvement. And I was talking to someone from the press. He said, well, you know, Benjamin Bloom said that, but most of the studies on, you know, scaled tutoring don't show that large of an effect. They do show an effect. You know, they show anywhere from, let's say, a third of a standard deviation to half of a standard deviation, which is still pretty significant, but still not 2 standard deviations. And what I told the reporter, I'm like, yes, but I still think 1 or 2 standard deviations is very plausible, that you could take a student from the 50th percentile to the 96th percentile. The reason why you're not seeing these in these large scale tutoring studies is that not all tutors are equal. You know, I could have everyone get a tennis coach, but not everyone is going to get the same level of coaching as if I had, you know, I don't know, Serena Williams coach it. And obviously Serena Williams has a lot of innate talent, but she also had access to incredible people mentoring and helping her, and which were probably better than, say, the average tennis coach. And so it's not just about tutoring. It needs to be really good tutoring. And what's cool about generative AI is it can have the aspects and the richness of a real interaction, but you can have quality control. You can scale it. So once you get it good, you can get it, you can give that same high quality interaction to a lot of folks. The other aspect that I realized when I was tutoring my cousins back in 2004, when we first think about tutoring, we think it's a lot about helping explain the academics. And there is that, you know, oh, you don't know how to factor a polynomial. Well, have you thought about this, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of like that conversation I just talked about supernovas with Conmigo. But a lot of what I was doing for my cousins, and I think what a great tutor does and a great teacher will do, is focus on motivation, focus on holding students accountable. Let's set some goals. Hey, I'm gonna. If you don't reach your goals, I'm gonna hold you to the fire a little bit and see why not. Hey, come on, I'm making time. You need to make time. You need to do some work on your own. If you're not showing up, I'm gonna call your mom and I'm gonna tell her to make you show up. I used to do this with Nadia. I used to call up my aunt Nusrat Aunty and say, hey, where's Nadia? Like, she needs fewer, you know, activities after school because she's not having the time to do the work that I'm giving her. And so, I think part of the reason why all of these ESSER dollars, the $86 billion after the pandemic that was spent on tutoring, kind of didn't work is, one, it was disjoint from what was happening in the classroom. Kids had to show up after school. The kids who needed it most weren't showing up. The tutors didn't know what was really going on in the classroom. The classroom didn't really know what was going on with the tutor. And the tutors, you know, the quality control was all over the place. So it's hard to know, you know, maybe I'm sure there were some really great tutors that saw some really impressive gains with their students, but we just didn't see that in the aggregate data because there was so much variation. So I think as we try to emulate aspects of that, you know, the key is let's connect it to what's happening in the classroom. Essentially the tutor and the teaching assistant should be the same entity. Let's make sure that the teacher is involved and that the tutoring is connected to what the teacher is doing. Let's make sure it can happen whenever the student needs it. Let's take down the logistic issues around going to a tutoring center and feeling embarrassed that you don't know it. And maybe you have soccer practice at the same time and you can't make it. Well, if it's online, if it's part of what's happening in the classroom, you don't face those same difficulties. And if it's connected to your parents and your teachers and it's leveraging them to help you stay engaged, then you, I think you have the right ingredients.
Sounds great. So one takeaway from that is that in the future, Conmigo will call my parents if I'm not performing well enough. That's great. That's the future I'm looking forward to. So speaking about systemic things and about like trying to understand the numbers, there is a lot in the news about standardized testing, right? Whether this is good or bad. So what is your take on standardized testing? And I know you take a stand on this in your book. And like, how do you view this our AI-powered education to really transform this this concept?
Yeah, I've always said, and I say this in the chapter on testing, you know, whenever someone says they're against standardized testing, I always say, which part do you not like, the standardized part or the testing part? And I say that because obviously to get good at anything, you need to measure it in some way, usually. And if you had to pick between standardized and unstandardized testing, it sounds like you'd want standardized because you could benchmark, you can understand where you are relative to a broader world. You know, people who are looking at that can view that as a signal of your capability versus if it's idiosyncratic to every teacher. Now, the problem with standardized tests is in order for it to both be standardized and for it to scale, the people narrowed the aperture of what they assess. And so they're assessing important things. Can you read a passage, answer a few questions about it? Can you do this multiple choice question in math, et cetera? So they are valuable things, but the problem is, and especially in schools and in areas where students are struggling with those, there's a tendency for, okay, this test can only, it's not measuring the 100% of things that matter. It's measuring, say, 30% of the things that matter, but that's all it's measuring. And if students are already struggling on those, there's a tendency for the school system to focus more on those things. But then this starts to lose a lot of other things that maybe aren't measured by standardized tests. So standardized tests, I think, are okay and actually can be a good thing. The important thing is to not let them artificially drive the education. It should be an and. You should be preparing for the things that are measured on standardized tests and doing other things. Now, I say that fully knowing well that that's hard. It's hard for that to be the reality when the incentives are, you know, this focus on test scores, et cetera. If that's how you're measured, you're going to want to optimize that. Now, the place where AI is exciting is it allows us to re-broaden that aperture of what could be a standardized test in the future. It could involve more open-ended responses, more writing. It could have oral parts of the exam. It could feel a lot more like a PhD thesis defense. There could be a creative aspect of it. You got to draw something and get critique on it. And then if AI allows you to broaden the aperture of the assessment, then the school system will now start caring about this broader set of things. Now, it does introduce another risk or fear that a lot of folks have with AI, which is, hey, AI assessing folks, that sounds scary. What if there's bias, what, et cetera? And even though a lot of people talk about, you know, most of these AIs are a set of numbers, you know, they're essentially big matrices. And it's hard, you know, they're models of essentially synapses in a super large brain. So it's hard to introspect exactly why sometimes it's leading to it saying this or that. But you can test them very rigorously. You can give them, you know, you can get human experts to evaluate 10 tests in different ways and then make sure that the AI is also giving that same evaluation. We're doing that right now, actually, with some of our essay work we're doing. We're making sure that the AI is giving the same feedback, at least on our true candles, on our test cases, that expert world-class essay graders would give. And you could also even test for different other forms of bias. You know, let's change the name, let's change this or that, and make sure that the AI does not, when you benchmark it on 1,000 different responses, it's not indexing on these things that it should not index on, like someone's gender or someone's age or someone's race, et cetera, et cetera. So in a lot of ways, you can also stress test these AI evaluators much better. You know, the rich exams that we have today in this world, you have things like PhD defenses, you know, oral exams. Hugely subjective, you know. There's if one of the senior tenured professors don't like you, you're kind of in bad shape, and there's no quality control or consistency for that. Job interviews, there's been studies, you know, you're more likely to get a job if you're interviewed in the morning when people are fresh than if you're interviewed in the afternoon. The same interviewer could be grumpy, you know, they just got a call from their partner and they're having an argument with them, and now all of a sudden they have to interview you. Your odds are not going to be good in that interview. So the systems we have already are incredibly biased and inconsistent. And even if we think about academic systems, you know, the standardized assessments that do attempt to broaden the aperture, if we think about IB or AP exams, where half of the exam are these free response questions where you have to write these things out. These are still graded by humans. Now, these humans are trained, they have rubrics, but they still are pretty subjective. And you can't test, you know, 10,000 true candle tests with one human being to see if they are truly grading those things consistently. So what I write a lot about in the book is we have to be very conscientious about using AI when it's evaluating. But the bar isn't perfection. The bar is it's better than the status quo with what human graders are doing.
Yeah, so I couldn't agree more that this whole question of AI and bias is very nuanced. In particular, I say that AI is never biased. It just reflects biases that we have in our world. And also, yes, like the baseline should be humans who are often biased, inscrutable, and essentially do errors all the time, make errors all the time. So yeah, so that's an important thing to keep in mind. I must say though that still, like, there is a bit of a fear of this Aurelian future where, like, you need to conform to certain norms. They might be unbiased norms, but still norms. Yes, like, essentially now you need to behave in certain way to fit in one of these kind of like ways of behaving, otherwise you will be outside of distribution and maybe you know, viewed as not a proper, like not the best student and so on. So again, as you say, if we are conscientious about this, if we are careful, I think much of this could be navigated, but I'm just saying this is definitely something that always in the back of my mind when I think about this application. So I'm not saying we should not be doing this. But actually, like, everything you said kind of brings me to the next question I had to you, for you actually, because as I was reading your book, I realized that it's actually a book about more than just AI and education. Like, you say a lot about, okay, AI should be an addition to human contact and human interactions, but like, this is the one thing, it again goes back to the movie Her, which I completely agree is an amazing movie and everyone should watch it. And again, I also, at that time, this was complete science fiction to me. Well, Siri was there, so you can kind of imagine this, but it still felt very distant. But like, wouldn't it be like, as AI will be better in talking to us and adjusting to us, and again, we will not be wasting its time and so on, like, don't you worry that as a society we will start fragmenting? Like, there is no point for me to talk to other humans because AI will be just, it will be easier. They will understand me. They will help me. So, like, how do you think about these dynamics here?
Yeah, I think that's a real concern. And, you know, I hope that as much as the AIs can be around for us in the middle of the night when we need someone to talk to, and if we don't have a partner or we don't have a family member around or a friend around, it's also able to coach us to go and make friends and be out there in the world, be a matchmaker of various sorts. You know, it could be a romantic matchmaker. I think you're going to see some pretty cool dating apps in the future where, you know, my AI agent and someone else's AI agent can kind of simulate, hey, I think we get along. We should get the real biological versions of us together. And so I think there's ways where it will be able to actually be a facilitator. But, you know, this once again is people have to invest in those types of use cases. And once again, we have to look at where the world is right now. Well before AI, these dynamics, cell phones, social media. I mean, the number of times I've been to a restaurant and I've seen an entire family staring at their phones and ignoring each other. In some ways, that's more dehumanizing than being alone and staring at a phone. Like you're in the same room and you're literally all ignoring each other. That's already happening. You already see, a generation of kids. I mean, especially in some parts of East Asia, where it's turned into an epidemic, where people aren't leaving their rooms because they're playing video games, or people are getting into these social media rabbit holes, and it's polarizing them or making them feel insecure about their lives. That's already happening, and that doesn't give a free pass to AI. But once again, I think this type of tool used well. I'm sure there's going to be people making use cases that take you into that rabbit hole even more. So that's going to happen. And, you know, I wish it wouldn't, but it will. But if there's good actors who make it, hey, this is going to help you get out into the world more. It's going to introduce you to more people. It's going to get you more physical activity. It'll help you meditate better. That will be a good thing.
Oh, yeah. Again, so I think we are in agreement here. Just like I think figuring out this exact like structure of how to do it will be quite a big endeavor, which I think we should embark on as a humanity. So kind of going back to things that matter particularly to me. So much of the efforts of Khan Academy is focused on K-12 education, and I think this is the right target. But there is education after that. You know, there is there are colleges, but there's also continual education. So how are you thinking about kind of Khan Academy in particular, but also AI changing that aspects of our education?
This is something we've always thought about at Khan Academy. And honestly, the thing that's held us back the most is our ability to just create the content fast enough. And this is where AI, once again, I don't think the AI is ready yet to just make, it can make content, but it still has errors and it's not always on target and not always aligned to the standards. But I think AI, like we are creating tools within Khan Academy that will make our content creators more productive, where they're still thumbs upping and thumbs downing and editing, but the AI can help. You know, if they used to create 5 exercises in a day, now they can create 20 exercises in a day. So one, even that will allow tools like Khan Academy to cover more ground, more subject areas, higher education, graduate school, professional learning eventually, or other people as well. And fundamentally, online learning has always been better at giving more flexibility to folks. It can obviously support people in a traditional school setting, but also from their dorm room at 3 a.m. But also, obviously, there's a lot of folks who are working and have a family. And, you know, instead of having to commute at night and do night school in the classic sense, they can just go to the computer and spend and not be away from their family. But, you know, they're learning for that half an hour, that hour, et cetera. And so I think AI will only enhance that. It'll provide just another layer. You know, one of the main critiques of, say, Khan Academy videos is that you can't ask any questions of the video. Well, now you can. Now you can go as far as you want. You can get that Socratic dialogue. And you could be connected to the professor in more ways. That, sure, you might have some live sessions with that live, real human being professor, or that real human being anything. And then the interactions that you have with the AI that's always available, the AI will also report back to the professor. So that the professor has a more holistic view of everything that you're up to. So yeah, simple answer is, I think this is going to accelerate not just ours, but everyone's ability to serve more in learning beyond K-12. And it's going to be more flexible. And I'll actually say one other thing, and we talked a little bit about this with assessment, where it can broaden the aperture of what you're doing. So it's already just a prompting exercise to make, you know, Khanmigo or ChatGPT give you a practice interview or give you practice interviewing someone else, which actually I recommend many people to try if they're going to be interviewed themselves, because then you put yourself in the mind of the interviewer. Or you know, right now business school, you know, I went to business school. It was 2 years of you're reading cases. And then you have a discussion about what would you have done if you were the CEO and you just discovered that, you know, one of your products was tainted, but you'll lose $1 billion if, you know, you do a recall and things like that. And that's great to have that discussion. But now the AI could walk you through a real simulation. Like, okay, now this happened. It's a choose your own adventure. Now this happened. Now what do you do? Do you think this is the right thing? And so that is a very formed, a very deep, but very relevant form of learning for well beyond. I mean, that's going to be relevant in K-12 and higher education, but it's going to be very relevant in the workplace as well.
Yeah, it will be really exciting where people really realize that you literally learn the whole life and you have this very easy tool that help you do that. So kind of towards wrapping up, like essentially in your book, you state that like you created Khan Academy inspired by the Foundation series, something like the series I'm also a fan of. So essentially you have this psychohistory that allows you to really understand how civilization will evolve far into the future. So given that you know, you are a fan of it, and yes, you said that you kind of cannot really predict the future, but still, what do you think that in the next couple of decades we might be the most surprised by in terms of technology, but also how society evolves?
Yeah, you know, a lot of folks obviously talk a lot about the dystopian science fiction, AI scenarios, Terminator, Matrix. We can think of others. You know, WALL-E, the Pixar movie, which I love, is maybe a slightly less dystopian, but still dystopian version. I tend to anchor more on the Star Trek reality. And if you think about Star Trek, it's a post-scarcity world, right? Machines, they don't say it explicitly in Star Trek, but if you want food, you just ask a replicator to create it for you. Communication, everything, it's just there. It's abundant. No one's going hungry in that reality. And so all of economics is based on the notion of scarcity. You know, we need markets and pricing. And I used to be a hedge fund analyst. This is all I did. You know, you need markets and pricing in order to figure out how to allocate those scarce resources. But when you think about the abundance that AI is going to create, the abundance that robotics with AI is going to create, society kind of has a choice. Do we become a Star Trek reality where everyone is able to become a researcher, an explorer, a doctor, a counselor, an artist, and they're going to be able to participate in that abundance? Or do we have some kind of dystopian world where, you know, a small fraction of people in Silicon Valley like you and me are going to be able to take advantage of this, and that everyone else is, you know, not able to participate, or you're just to keep society stable, you're going to have mass redistribution. And, you know, redistribution is usually the people who don't like redistribution are usually the people who are taxed heavily, say, oh, that was my earnings, why are you giving it to other people? But I actually think it's even worse for the people getting it if they don't have a sense of purpose or a sense of meaning. If I think at the end of the day, human beings, more than any luxury, want to feel needed, want to have a sense of purpose. And obviously, we also want to be connected to other people. So the redistribution version is kind of what happens in WALL-E, where people don't have a lot to do. That's not a good reality. So I say, I hope, and I will work for, hopefully other people, well, let's go to a Star Trek reality. And the best way to get as many people as possible to participate in that knowledge economy at the top of the labor pyramid is through education. And then let's use these same tools that are going to disrupt and dislocate the labor market in certain ways, but let's use those tools to upskill everyone's capabilities. So, you know, right now, maybe 5% of people get an education where they become a researcher. What if it could be 30 or 40%? Think about the drugs we will discover. Think about the problems we would solve. Similarly, you know, right now, 5, 10% get the education or the opportunity to be an entrepreneur. What if that becomes 80%? Think about the innovation we'll see. So that's what I want to see.
So, yeah, I definitely resonate with that vision. And this brings me to my final traditional question. So if you think about AI and what it will bring, so what is that you personally and maybe outside of Khan Academy are looking forward the most or maybe the least?
I'll start with the least. I really don't, you know, I'm sure AI is going to be used for fraud attack. I mean, it's already happening for fraud, deepfakes, misinformation, polarizing content. I'm worried about that. I'm already, you know, we have a passcode in the family so that, you know, if one day I get a call from something that sounds like my child, I can, what's the passcode? So I can verify it. The stuff that I'm most personally interested in is AI as a tool of creative output. You know, there's a part of me that always wanted to one day say, maybe I could make a epic video game or an epic movie. But I don't know if I would be good at it, but I've never felt like I would even be able to enter that field because the gatekeepers might have not even paid attention to me. But I, you know, as a form of creative expression, just the same way YouTube allowed us to bypass the gatekeepers. You know, I didn't have to pitch my videos to someone at Pearson in order to publish them to teachers and students. I was just able to publish them. And obviously I was able to use other technologies to produce it for very low cost. Now you have a world where you're going to be able to make movies. You're going to be able to make really immersive games. You're going to be able to make, you know, even, you know, epic novels. And once again, the AI isn't going to do it all. It's going to be very important for the human creative to be the editor, to be guiding it. But you're going to have a lot more people to be able to express themselves a lot better. Now, a lot of it's not going to be good, just as a lot of YouTube isn't good. But you're also going to discover a lot of really amazing things that would not have been discovered otherwise. So I'm excited about that personally. You know, I've told my son, he's really into piano. And I said, look, you should, why don't you start making some music videos for these piano pieces you're writing? You know, go use, you know, these generative AI, but, you know, make it really meaningful for you. Like, that's an amazing, like, that wasn't available to us when we were teenagers. You can go make a really cool music video. That's available to them. In a few years, you know, some stuff y'all working on with Sora, most people are going to be able to make, you know, really high quality shorts. And it's not going to be based on the budget you have or the studio you're affiliated with. It's going to be based on your creativity and your sense of story and doing something new. And I think that's a pretty exciting world.
Yeah, so I guess you used to be a cartoonist. You sang in a heavy metal band. So now you can discover all the other talents here. Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you, Sal. This was a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Alexander.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. If so, please share this podcast with your friends, subscribe, and leave feedback in the comments.